Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It's Friday, which means it's Free for All Friday here at the Council of Trent podcast. I am your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And on Fridays, we dive into all sorts of interesting topics to help edify you, learn about the world, and just have some good old fun. Before we get into that, though, I want to do a quick reminder. If you like what you hear on the podcast, consider supporting it at TrenthornPodcast.com. For as little as $5 a month, you get access to bonus content, and you help us reach so many more people. Be sure to check that out at TrenthornPodcast.com. One recent bonus content we have is an overview of a dialogue I had with an atheist on the Kalam cosmological argument. My friend John DeRosa does a wonderful play-by-play, walking you through doing apologetics with me as an example. So be sure to check that out at TrenthornPodcast.com if you are a patron and a subscriber there. Otherwise, if you just listen to the podcast, consider leaving a review at iTunes or Google Play. That always helps people to see this podcast is worth their time and worth sharing with their friends and family. Now, without further ado, our guest today is the one and only Harold Beeson, my father-in-law, in town with the lovely Margie Beeson, visiting all of us. So I thought I'd have Harold come down here to the Catholic Answers studio, and we talk about his areas of expertise and his previous work at NASA, studying how things blow up and how to keep them from blowing up, which are always great skills to have in life that you can apply anywhere. So to learn more about him, Dr. Harold Beeson recently retired from his position as Chief of the Materials and Components Laboratories Office at the NASA White Sands Test Facility in Las Cruces, New Mexico, after 28 years of service to NASA, and has joined the WHA International as a principal chemist and forensic scientist. He received his doctorate in chemistry from the University of New Mexico, where he began his career as a research scientist for the New Mexico Engineering Research Institute. The author of over 200 papers and presentations, he's led teams that developed NASA propellant safety manuals for hydrogen and oxygen, and has been an instructor for NASA and industry in courses on hydrogen safety and oxygen safety. He has experience in fire extinguishing, spacecraft fire safety, cleaning of hardware for aerospace, detonations and explosions. However, Harold has focused much of his recent technical effort into the safety of oxygen, hydrogen, and composite overwrapped pressure vessels. He is married to Margie. They have 3 girls and 11 grandchildren. I am married to one of them, and they're currently helping us with 2 of the grandchildren who are very rambunctious at their current ages. Dr. Harold Beeson, welcome to the Council of Trent podcast.
Trent, it's really good to be here, and it's always a pleasure to come here to San Diego to visit you guys, to have some good food, you know, but most importantly for us, I think it's like, well, are you going to go visit your daughter? Yeah, but we're really going to go visit the grandkids. So, you know, that's the drawing point. Not that the daughter's not important, but the grandkids are there.
You know? That's quite all right. If you want to hang on to them for as long as you want. No, because I know we're about to go out here soon and they'll be with you for a little bit. This is always what happens to parents. I was like, any time away from my kids. And then when you go out and you sit down at dinner and you're away from them, you go, what do we talk about? Did you see what Matthew did the other day? Oh, I know. It's like, well, we miss them now. It's just sometimes parents, we really just need 10 minutes. That's all we need. And then we're back up to stuff. No, we're glad you're here. And obviously it must be a gigantic sacrifice having a daughter and a son-in-law who live in San Diego. Like, oh, I got to go to San Diego to see him, I guess.
It is. The weather here, you know, is iffy at best, you know. So we had to, you know, leave the 100-degree Las Cruces weather and come here to the, you know, 85 temperate climate. I think it was like 60 last night here. So nice and cool. It was pretty awesome.
It's crisp. So talking about temperature, your work with NASA, you study fire, oxygen fires, chemistry. How did you get, where did your fascination with fire begin?
Well, I think it really began when I was 5 years old. I burned down my playhouse. And
always a great start to a future career.
It is. And it was cold outside. And so me and a friend of mine from across the street and my brand new horny toad pet went inside of the playhouse and we built a real fire in a pretend fireplace. And so,
oh, of course.
Yeah. So you really, you know, I learned something very, very helpful even in my career now is that you should never really try to build a real fire in a pretend fireplace. You need to know what you're doing. And if you're dealing with dangerous stuff, You better know what the dangers are.
You pretend fires in real fireplaces, or pretend fires in pretend fireplaces.
Or a real fires.
In a real fireplace.
Yeah, you want real fires in a real fireplace, not real fires in a pretend fireplace.
Did you get in trouble?
I got in a lot of trouble. I can remember the fire chief coming into the house. All the adults were kind of sitting around, and the fire chief said, if I was that kid's dad, I'd spank his bottom. And my dad walked into that time and says, that sounds like a wonderful idea. So
this is back then, there was the fire, your parents got on the telegraph and sent out a message like, oh no, there's a there's a fire here. Oh.
Actually, they used smoke signals, which was advantageous because the fire was already started.
Okay, good. All right, so your first fascination begins when you're five, but then you went on, you studied chemistry. I'm always fascinated why certain people go into the hard sciences, because most people I know in my circles have done liberal arts or business. I don't meet a lot of people who purposely go into the hard sciences like chemistry. Why did you want to go into that?
Well, I always liked chemistry. Again, not to dwell too much on my childhood, but you know, when you were a kid growing up in the 60s and 70s, you could get a chemistry set that had real chemicals in it. And it had a real alcohol burner in it. And it had real test tubes and stuff like that. Stuff that they would never sell today.
The actual game of Operation came with scalpels.
It was close to that. I mean, it was
no,
really...
Who needs the underwriter's laboratory at this point?
Yeah. You know, it's before all the lists of safe toys came out. So yet
they had all the before all these lawsuits, kids could be kids.
Yeah. And,
okay, so you were playing with real chemistry sets, basically.
Real chemistry sets, and then in high school, I enjoyed honors chemistry. And mm-hmm. when I went to college, I really started out in pre-med, and then went from pre-med. I didn't get into medical school the first time, so I made a commitment to my research director
now
in chemistry.
Now, your dad's a doctor. Did that play into a little bit? You think, oh, I'll go to medical school.
Yeah, that played into it, and then. When I didn't get into medical school, my research director said, okay, I'll put you on, but you have to promise you'll be here for a master's.
Right.
And so then when the med school called me back a year later, at that time I was having fun, and I said, I really want to go on for a doctorate in chemistry.
No, I think what's interesting when people choose their different fields, I think a lot of that will relate to sometimes the teachers we have that inspire us. Because for me, math and science, it didn't come naturally, and I did not have great science teachers growing up. I remember my chemistry teacher used to say to us when we had questions, guys, these aren't my notes. Don't ask me a ton of questions. Like, she had no idea what she was talking about. But I had a great history teacher, and so that's why now my passions, I went on and majored in ancient history in college, and it's interesting where how we're formed as a, you know, child, teenager, college, the different directions that it takes us. And I'm sure you probably had mentors and others who inspired you when you were my age.
Oh, yeah, you bet. I mean, all along, mentoring is extremely important and teachers are extremely important. I had good science teachers in high school and, of course, in college. My research director, Dr. Robert Tapscott, was just an awesome individual. And actually, is part of the reason why I'm Catholic. I was raised Church of Christ.
Right.
And it was part of his example for him joining the Catholic Church that I started looking at the Catholic Church seriously. So he's a mentor in more than just the sciences.
Now, Laura's told me this desire to teach, it carried over even when the kids were little. She told me once that you explained to her how warmth and energy and molecules worked by, like, huddling up as a molecule and running around the room to show that's how things get warmer?
Oh, yeah, sure. You know, I'm bouncing against the wall. So as things get warmer, the reason why we feel the temperature more is that we're hitting molecules are hitting us, and they're hitting us with more energy. And so, you know, we'd go bouncing around the walls, and I'd demonstrate both temperature and pressure by hitting the walls with the kids, you know, and that sort of stuff. So, yeah. You know, and people learn different ways. I was never I can't read a book necessarily and learn real well. I learn better by experience. Mm-hmm. So,
now how did then you got a doctorate in chemistry? How did that eventually move on into a career at NASA?
So I worked at the New Mexico Engineering Research Institute, and there did a lot of work developing firefighting techniques for the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And so things like I worked on the development of a magnesium fire extinguishing agent. I also worked on the development of halon replacements and that sort of stuff.
So I've seen this before. I've been in labs where, obviously, if there's a fire, sometimes water is not the best thing to put it out.
Oh, no. Sometimes if it's a metal fire, water's the absolute worst thing, because if you put water on a metal fire, like a magnesium fire, it will actually cause hydrogen to be evolved, mm-hmm. and that hydrogen, when it is evolved, will subsequently detonate and explode. And cause more damage.
So that's why you need, and I've seen some places they have halon gas emitters, like halon will come down, it'll starve the oxygen of fire, but you came up with stuff to like replace that?
Well, halon won't work on a metal fire because
it's too
hot, and it will actually decompose the halon and cause those molecules themselves will be combustible.
Oh, wow.
And so that doesn't work on a metal fire. Really, the only thing that works on a metal fire is the early stuff that they used was sand, and then they used kind of a polymer replacement for sand, and then we used a liquid fire extinguishing agent that we could use, it was actually trimethoxyboroxine, that's the chemical, and it would form a ceramic with the magnesium and put it out.
Oh, okay, so like it almost turns into like almost like a like pottery.
Yes, exactly. It forms a very, very durable shell on the magnesium.
So that reminds me, because we were watching the HBO miniseries Chernobyl last night. And so it's nice to have an oxygen and fire specialist with us in the room that I was talking about that in a previous Free for All Friday. I think it was 1 or 2 weeks ago. I was talking about atomic power and people are scared of it because of Chernobyl, which I've said being afraid of atomic power because of Chernobyl is like being afraid of cruise liners because of the Titanic. It's like, you know, there's always going to be disasters, but sometimes that doesn't mean that the whole thing is bad, obviously.
Oh, no. And there's a lot of things that we have to do in our life that have inherent hazards associated with them. I mean, I drove in San Diego with you today. I mean, that was inherently hazardous. And so we got here safely.
This is true. You might have said, oh, my gosh, it's so beautiful here. Life has no meaning for me anymore because I've seen the beauty here in San Diego. But we're watching that, like, when at Chernobyl, when Reactor 4 exploded and there was a fire that erupted, they ended up having just to use sand to put it out, because, or at least that's what I understand what they had to
do. That's one of the things that they used. I mean, because of the nature of the fire, what happens is certain fires flame, mm-hmm. other fires will smolder. And so, for example, you can have like a tire fire or a coal seam fire. In fact, you probably have talked about, I think, on one of your podcasts, how these coal seam fires have burned for centuries.
Centralia, Pennsylvania has a coal seam fire underground, and that fire is going to burn for like another 250 years.
So think about Chernobyl. There, in that reactor was graphite.
Yeah.
Coal, graphite. They're mm-hmm. the same chemical.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
So graphite is just a particular, coal is primarily carbon. Mm-hmm. Graphite is a particular crystal structure of carbon.
Okay.
And so you basically had a smoldering coal fire mm-hmm. going on there that was continually being heated by nuclear decay.
Right.
And so you had to do something to make sure that you could put it out. So they had to use sand, but they also had to take the heat out some way. And so I'm not sure how they did that. I think they did use copious amounts of water at some point.
Yeah, then I thought they were trying to build a heat exchanger underneath,
right. So
before it hit the groundwater.
Right. So they had to do that, and I just don't know what the particulars of it. But maybe mm-hmm. as we watch the miniseries, I'll learn.
Yes, comrade. You must go home and finish the last four episodes. Although everyone there seemed to have a British accent, though. But that makes it a miniseries. Let's talk then about how your involvement at NASA when it comes to fire safety and fire tech. What were some things, notable things in your career that you worked on that you're allowed to tell us? Because some of your things are above top secret.
No, none of actually very little stuff that I worked on was classified at NASA. So, and most of that was for other government agencies. So, I would say probably there's been, I've been pretty blessed in my career, let mm-hmm. me just say. There's been things that, obviously if you're dealing with fire, a lot of times what you're called in to do is to look at what happened after the tragedy or mm-hmm. after the accident and that sort of stuff. So there's been some great things that I've been able to do. Two of the most notable things, I think, are we had a fire early when we were doing the phase one, what's called phase one. It was the first time we ever experimented with a space station in modern days. We actually used the Mir station.
Mm-hmm. The Russian station.
The Russian station. And so there's a great book called Dragonfly that you can read about the that phase one program and what it was all about. Mm-hmm. But in the Mir station, we had a fire, mm-hmm. and it was in the oxygen generating system that they used, which is a solid oxygen generating system, much like is used on an airplane.
Right.
And so when you pull down the mask on an, by the way, if they ever tell you to pull down the mask, it's because there's a hole in the airplane and it's depressurized. Just, you know, don't panic.
Don't panic. There's just a hole in the metal cylinder you're in 30,000 feet up in the air. No reason to panic.
That's exactly right. So, and when you pull down on that, mask and they say pull down and that will start the flow of oxygen.
Right.
What that does is it releases a firing pin in a percussive primer, which starts the chemical reaction, which releases the oxygen.
Right.
From the solid oxygen fuel generator.
Oh, okay. So, it's not like there's just these tanks that are constantly pumping air. You pull down your mask, it releases a firing pin, and it creates a chemical reaction that generates oxygen.
That's exactly right.
What's interesting is that was a reason, actually, a plane crash in the 1990s, the Value Jet crash in Florida, which, by the way, on Free For All Friday, we got to get back to some disaster episodes. I haven't done these in forever, and have so many tucked away. So in that one, they were transporting in the cargo hold those oxygen tanks, but the pins were like barely taped on. They were being transported in a dangerous way, and I think they ended up overheating, and that is what brought the
yeah,
plane down.
Yeah, so actually what happened is when they did their rollout and climb, the load shifted, and one of the generators fired because the pin had either fallen out or wasn't secured properly.
Right.
And that caused the rest of the generators inside the box to cook off. And when they redid the test, the FAA redid the test, and the thermocouple actually stopped working at 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit because it burned up the thermocouple.
Oh, wow.
And so these oxygen fires are extremely hot.
Yeah, because most...
And you're burning the metal.
Right, because in a cargo hold, usually they have protection in a plane that cargo hold is sealed. So if there were a fire, it would just starve itself of oxygen. But that doesn't work if you have a system that's creating its own oxygen.
Exactly. We talk about the fire triangle a lot. And so you have, for a fire to occur, For the fire to occur, you have to have an ignition source, you have to have a fuel, and you have to have an oxidizer. Well, in this case, I mean, your ignition sources are a lot of times inherent in the system. Mm-hmm. Your fuel is the system itself because most metals will burn in oxygen. Mm-hmm. And then you can't get rid of the oxygen because then you don't have an oxygen system. So those are some of the things that you have to... So there's no way to break the fire triangle. Mm-hmm.
So then you have to come up with ways, like if you've got this kind of oxygen fire that's burning when it's not supposed to, you have to have some kind of response to it, like to be able to break this triangle or get around it somehow.
Yeah, remove the heat from the fire and stuff like that. So on the Mir fire, though, I mean, what happened there is they had this solid fuel oxygen generator, and it caught fire. It burned for about 20 minutes. They used the fire extinguishers that were on the Mir station, and eventually they put the fire out, and very heroically, because they almost lost the station.
Oh, wow.
And so afterwards, then, we actually had that same oxygen system on the International Space Station. So before we could fly it to International Space Station, we had to understand what the hazards were and if we had properly controlled the fire that was going on.
Let's talk a little bit about the things that you've done at NASA in particular, or NASA in general, that have real-world applications here. And I could see how this could have real-world applications in industry and anywhere else where you're dealing with fire and with chemicals. But I think a lot of people think that NASA is just about guys playing golf on the moon, basically, and they think, well, what does it have to do with us here on Earth? And that's not really the case.
No, I think, because NASA touches our lives all the time. Mm-hmm. We may not even know about it, but the fact that you can open up your weather app and actually see satellite images of what's going on, well, that goes back to NASA.
I mean,
and so those weather satellites that are orbiting are launched in cooperation with NASA. So even at that point, I mean, every day you're looking at the weather app, you're sitting there saying, well, that's brought to you by NASA research.
Or GPS. Everything we've got that helps us, it's circling over the Earth, had to get up there on a rocket, which needs fuel, which is controlled fires, and that's right back to your department.
That's exactly right. And then if you look at...
Because we don't have those rail guns yet just to shoot it into space. Not yet.
Yeah, those are a little bit far off, and there's some inherent issues associated with it. The problem is that you have to have giant vacuum chambers, other thing that burns up when it gets that fast. But no. So I won't go down that road quick. So, but, you know, on another practical level... one of the issues that I worked with personally was in the auction world is back in the late 90s, there was a series of fires that became very prevalent in medical oxygen regulators. So you've seen, you know, maybe that your mother-in-law or mother or grandmother, you'll see them walking around. They'll have an oxygen bottle that they're walking along. On top of that oxygen bottle, there's usually, sometimes they're blue or red colored. There's a regulator on top of that oxygen bottle.
Right.
Well, they switched. Those bottles used to be made out of one material, and they switched to another material, aluminum. And all of a sudden, they started having fires in these oxygen regulators.
Oh, gosh. So, connected with, like, senior citizens that are toting them around.
Yeah, and a lot of times as emergency, the most severe use of these is in the emergency services.
Right.
And so emergency services would arrive, they'd pull out their oxygen system, they'd open up the valve, and they'd have a fire.
And, oh, gosh.
Right there and with the patient.
So they have another emergency on top of their emergency.
Exactly. So, and there was like 200 of these fires.
Wow.
And a few fatalities. So the Food and Drug Administration regulates the use of oxygen because oxygen is a drug. And so they were ready to just say, look, you can't use aluminum in oxygen systems, but it has some great properties. It's easier to manufacture. It's lighter weight, mm-hmm. you know. And so what we did is we said, wait, why don't we work together, and we did with industry, to develop a test so we could clearly demonstrate that even if you had an ignition mm-hmm. in the aluminum regulator, it would not propagate and blow out the regulator and cause further damage. Now, the regulator may cease to function, mm-hmm. but you don't have metal oxide, burning metal particles flying at your face.
So it's kind of like you've redesigned into the system a controlled failure.
Exactly. And so that test method has been adopted by industry and is now used to qualify every medical oxygen regulator that's used in throughout industry and worldwide, actually.
Something else practical I noticed that I went and visited the White Sands facility with you when I was in New Mexico a few years ago, and I met one of your colleagues who is involved with smell testing and off-gassing, which I thought was a really fascinating thing I hadn't thought about before that maybe you could tell us a bit more about. That his goal is to see, how is this stuff going to smell when it ends up in space with people? Like, you know, like sometimes when I get a rental car, I put my head in and it smells terrible because someone's smoking. At least I can be like, I'm going to go with the Hyundai instead or something. But when you're up in space and the off-gassing is really bad or hazardous, you don't have many other options. That's something I'd never thought about before until I stopped by your facility.
Yeah, no, smell is you know, it's one of the five senses, right? And it's primary. It's, you know, it's the way we interact with the environment, and it's a very powerful way to interact with the environment. And so smells can make you physically sick pretty quickly. They can, and the chemicals that are causing the smell can give you headaches, you know, and that sort of stuff. So so we do every material that is flown in a manned space capsule, mm-hmm. a human space capsule is tested to ensure that it does not off-gas toxic products. Mm-hmm. And then some subset of that, depending on what the qualification requirements are, also go through this odor test to make sure that it does not give off so much of a pungent odor mm-hmm. that it would cause you to get sick. And we've had, you know, we had missions that were brought back early. We had a shuttle mission where they had a freezer called the ORF, the Orbiter Refrigerator Freezer. Okay. Mm-hmm. We always have an acronym for everything. So this ORF.
The AFEs, the acronyms for everything.
Yes. Right. So as soon as the orbiter landed, they pulled this refrigerator off, sent it to our facility, and we did a whole series of tests to understand what was the failure that the astronauts were smelling that was causing them all to get sick.
And someone's like, hey, Aldrin left his ham sandwich in here. Buzz! You get on the moon, you don't get a free pass on everything. Get your food out of the freezer. Oh, sorry about that, guys. I just got done punching a guy in the face for saying we never went to the moon, which really did happen, by the way.
It wasn't the ham sandwich, but you know, it is something. But so that being able to understand those sorts of things really is a problem. Because I mean, here on Earth, you're used to if something smells, you know, you roll down the window, you turn on a fan, you know. But what you're doing is exhaust everything to the outside environment in space or on a submarine where they have the exact same issue.
Problem. Yeah.
So then there's
you can't roll
down the window, you know. So you just have to live with it.
Which actually brings another question I wanted to ask you further along, but this is a good place to mention it since I wanted to cover our space questions with our resident NASA expert. What would happen to me if I was just in space without a spacesuit? I decided to roll down the window, get some quote-unquote fresh air in the vacuum of space. What would happen to me out there?
So if you were in the capsule, nothing. So as long as it's enclosed and everything like that. But if you get a hole in your capsule or if you get a hole in your spacesuit, then you can't stand the vacuum of space. And there's it's actually a probably fairly good realistic depiction of this in the movie, I think, Total Recall, is it, with Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, where he falls out of the
Mars, which has an atmosphere, but it doesn't have really any oxygen.
Right. It's got CO2, but it's also subatmospheric.
And yeah.
That's the issue is the vacuum of space,
right.
the low pressure of space is such that the boiling point of your blood is well below your body temperature. So immediately your blood boils.
Oh.
And
and then you do what Arnold did in the movie. Ah, my eyes are bulging out of my head. Ah.
Same sort of thing. Anything that has gas associated with it, so blood, lungs, eyeballs, nostril passages, sinuses, any of those things are going to try to expand very quickly. Your eardrums, you know, things like that, and then less gaseous substances are going to take a little bit longer to fail. But it's not going to be good.
Well, you know what, Mr. Elon Musk? I'm going to stay on Earth right now, mister. I don't need to head into space anytime soon to have my blood boil. Let me then ask you another question, Mr. NASA expert. Did we actually get to the moon? I mean, it's so far away up there. Did we really get up there?
It is far away, and it took a lot of work and a lot of courage by people. And by the way, we went to the moon on less computer capacity than you have in your iPhone, much less. So we did go to the moon. It took an awful lot to go there. And a lot of brave people. I mean, one of the reasons why I do the test, we did the testing that we did at the NASA White Sands Test Facility, they still do it.
Right.
Is a lot of we test materials, every material that goes up is tested for its flammability. And that's a direct result of the Apollo 1 accident that killed Chaffee, White, and Grissom.
Was that the one that exploded on the platform?
Yes, it exploded during testing. Mm-hmm. And, it caught fire. Subsequently, the fire did rupture the hatch, but it wasn't like it exploded first. It was a fire inside the space capsule. And so that caused a total redesign. One of the criticisms that NASA got coming out of the investigation board was that we didn't have a good, clean materials control program.
Mm-hmm.
And so we developed that in order to understand the flammability of the materials and to make sure that we could control the fire hazards that we have in space. And the other change that we made is at that point in time, they were operating that spacecraft in pure oxygen.
Oh, wow.
And so they went to a different oxygen mix after that. So, in space stations operate at 21% oxygen, which is our atmospheric oxygen concentration.
Right.
And atmospheric pressure. It's basically a short-sleeve environment inside of space station.
So by applying this, they've developed other kinds of safety mechanisms. Because while we were driving here, we were talking about these launches, how things can be dangerous. You said that where people observe the rocket or a spacecraft launch, they're what, like 3 miles away from the platform?
Yeah, the closest people are either in, if they're fairly close, there's a first response team that's actually in armored, was at least in shuttle the way they staged it. I don't know how they're going to stage it in the future missions, but you had a group of firefighters and emergency personnel that were actually in armored personnel carriers behind berms, and they were probably the closest. Then you had the launch control team, which was 3 miles away, but they were in a blast hardened shuttered building behind them, another several hundred feet away, where they had some stands for VIPs, but the general public was much farther away than that.
Yeah, and you said that even in the blast bunker, like if that rocket just exploded, you would see the flash, and then like these shields or shutters almost would come over the windows to like protect this. The zone before they got hit,
right?
Basically.
Protect the launch control panel before it got hit. Yeah, you bet.
Speaking of big explosions, that reminds me of Michael Bay, which reminds me of the movie Armageddon. So, is NASA on the lookout? Because recently we had not a Earth killer asteroid, but we had a city killer asteroid pass between the Earth and the Moon. That if it hit a major city, it could have destroyed it. Is NASA, one, keeping an eye on killer asteroids, and two, if it finds one big enough, could we send Bruce Willis up there to blow it up?
So the answer there is somewhat complex. I looked at it a little bit, and I'm not involved in that side of NASA, never have been. But in looking at it, a couple things. First of all, our ability to track asteroids have been somewhat start and stop. There's been several programs in order to track these asteroids. Right now, we are under congressional mandate to by 2020 be able to track any asteroid that could do substantial damage to the Earth. We are constantly being bombarded by meteorites,
right,
which are very small, pieces of space junk that are entering, as well as other space junk. I mean, there's always space junk reentering that's burning up. Some of it is old spacecraft parts, tanks, used satellites.
Then don't crash in the moon. You told me that one of the Israelis just crashed on the moon and they contaminated it.
Yeah, the Israelis just crashed one of their spacecraft on the moon and it had, I guess what's supposed to be, and I forgot the name,
It's called a water bear?
Water bear is what the common name is. And so it's like the most indestructible species on Earth that can survive to almost absolute zero and up to 250 degrees C.
They're a microbe. It's not like some kind of actual bear.
It's a little microbe.
Turns
thing.
Out there's this bear that's indestructible, so the Israelis sent them into space, which is a good plan, I guess, if you have indestructible bears. So now they're there on the... just on the moon right now, but then other stuff falls back to Earth and it burns up in the atmosphere.
Yeah, you bet. So right now we do have a congressional mandate to by 2020 be able to track these asteroids. We do have tracking devices that are able to do that, several telescopes. The Palomar Observatory is one of those that's used to track these, and they've had other observatories that are able to look at it. Once they sense something, then they'll put more assets to track it and see what its actual distance is, where it might pass, and those sorts of things as it comes towards Earth. And like you said, back in July 19th, we had one that came fairly close.
Yeah.
To the Earth. By the way, when you talk about fairly close to the Earth, they consider like within 100,000 miles a really near miss. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these things, when they say, "Well, it came close to the Earth," and they actually give the distance. Well, it's a million miles away, which is the distance between the moon and the Earth.
Oh, okay.
So.
Yeah, so we're still okay. We don't need Bruce Willis and Ben Affleck and Steve Buscemi to head up into space. I love watching those movies with you, by the way, because you can always point out what they're getting wrong, things that I don't think of, like using their asteroid drilling tank that clearly has an internal combustion engine that wouldn't work up there.
Yeah, so internal combustion doesn't work in the vacuum of space. So, yeah. Things like that, little nuances. That
so,
they
like
have.
The rovers we use, like if we're going on the moon, they have to rely on things like electric batteries or solar or even nuclear?
So if we're using a rover, the different technologies, some of it, if it's short term, then batteries can be used.
Right.
Or battery combination with solar. And then at some point you're using what's called an RTG, which is a little nuclear reactor that provides reliable electric power, and it's fairly small, that can go on a device and help power it. And that's one of the big issues. You talk about future NASA.
Mm-hmm.
We want to go back to the moon, and
right.
then on to Mars. When we go back to the moon, it's not going to be for a two-day camping trip. It's going to be for a long-term commitment
right.
to being on the surface of the moon. So battery technology, all of those sorts of things are going to be having to be better developed. Things like fuel cells, where you can take water
yeah.
and use that water to make hydrogen and oxygen, or take hydrogen and oxygen and use it to make water and electricity. Those are the sorts of things that we'll develop. And
yeah.
all of that stuff gets put right back into our technology here.
Yeah, to develop power, clean water for people who just have these basic materials. What amazes me, if you were to go back in time and meet the Apollo 11 team, or everyone was trying to get a man on the moon, and you said, you show them, oh, here's my iPhone. And they're like, oh my goodness, look at this computing power. Like, if they could see what we have now to do the same mission, I mean, they'd be blown away by that.
Oh yeah, I think so. And a lot of them have developed along the way with that. But NASA technology really does, it comes down and impacts our day-to-day life. And so, and it's important that we understand that we utilize it, for good and not for evil, all of those
right.
sorts of things.
We see that science is our friend, it's not our enemy, and especially as people of faith, it's not our enemy. So my last question for you is this. As a Catholic scientist, do you ever find conflicts with faith and reason, or other kind of conflicts related to your work as someone who's a faithful Catholic and someone who works in the hard sciences?
Yeah, I can tell you at one time I did, and it was because of the fact that coming out of the Church of Christ and mm-hmm. in the era when it came out, I was kind of a young earth creationist.
Right.
And so getting that was conflict. And so what I tended to do was avoid the questions. I'd avoid the questions of how we got here and what happens to us after we die, right?
Right.
Because one, I couldn't understand intellectually.
Right.
And the other one, I can't understand and still don't understand.
Right.
And then I can tell you is that you were going over a talk that you're going to give at University of Arizona, in which you presented the Klom argument.
Oh yes.
To us, and we were just in our living room, and that clicked a switch in my head that allowed me to think differently about faith and science, and all of a sudden, my world just opened up, and there's no conflicts, It was resolved. The other point there is, last year at the Catholic Answers Conference, mm-hmm. Stacey Tersenkos, she said something that, again, it's one of those switches that flip.
Right.
And that is that science is the study of the handiwork of God.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about science in those terms, how can there be a conflict? And if there's a conflict, who's wrong? Is it the creator of science that's wrong?
Or is it
us, the scientists, that are wrong?
Psalm 19:1, the heavens are the handiwork of God. The sky proclaims its builder's craft. Yeah, I love it.
It is.
I love it. Well, Harold, Dr. Beeson, thank you so much for being on the show today. Any resources you would recommend for people who want to learn more about NASA, learn more about astronomy, or even fire safety and technology? Share the wisdom with us, any directions you think we should go.
So there's for NASA, there's a great app that you can get on your phone. It's the NASA app, and it goes through every program that we have. It kind of goes through a lot of the history of NASA and those sorts of things. So that's a good resource as far as web resources and that sort of stuff. As far as a great common resources for about fires and stuff like that, I think the nightly news might be the best source.
There's always something. There's a conflagration, but there are people like you figuring out how to put them out and keep them from starting in the first place.
You bet.
Thank you, sir, for being on the podcast today.
It's been a pleasure, Trent. Thank you, and I'm proud of you and I'm proud of the work that you do here.
Now I'm gonna cry.
try.
Thank you so much, Harold. And thank you all for listening. I hope you enjoyed the program today. Can't wait to be back with you next week with all new episodes. You all take care, and I hope you all have a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.